This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Former President Trump will be arraigned in Miami federal court tomorrow. He's charged with 37 counts in the federal classified documents case. CBS's Robert Costa.
The former president is huddling with his attorneys in Florida. Sources say when he arrives at the courthouse, he will plead not guilty. They also say that Trump's legal strategy at this time is directed by him and comes down to one phrase: fight everything.
More from CBS's Catherine Herridge.
The classified records strewn throughout Mar-a-Lago in a public ballroom, a bathroom, and tossed on a storage room floor are among the nation's most closely held secrets. Of the 31 charges for the willful retention of national defense information, 21 involve top secret documents. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton worked in the Trump White House.
This was a risk to national security beyond calculation.
Bolton told CBS News special handling suggests a special access program which can be so secret the government doesn't acknowledge its existence.
Pennsylvania's governor says it could take months to fix the stretch of I-95 in Philadelphia that collapsed after a fiery truck crash yesterday. More from KYW's Justin Udo in Philadelphia.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Mike Carroll says the damaged infrastructure on 95 will get worse before it gets better, and adds even though the collapse happened on the northbound side, it affects a lot more than that.
And the inspection of the southbound bridge indicated it's compromised as a result of the fire. The I-beams are incapable of supporting the traffic, and so that structure has to be removed.
Carroll, who expects the demolition to be completed in the next 4 to 5 days, says they now have a better idea of what happened to cause the collapse.
From what we understand, the tractor and trailer is trying to navigate the curve, lost control of the vehicle, landed on its side, and ruptured the tank and ignited the fire.
Remains have been recovered and have yet to be identified. After initially denying a report that China was interested in establishing a spying post targeting the U.S. in Cuba, an anonymous official said the post had been established as early as 2019. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby.
The sensitive nature of this information is such that we just simply couldn't go into more detail, even before the first story appeared.
Illinois becomes the first state in the nation to ban book bans. Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed into law a bill which prevents grant funding to libraries that fail adherence to the American Library Association's Library Bill of Rights, which says reading material should not be removed or restricted because of partisan or personal disapproval. Governor Pritzker says of young people,
I want them to become critical thinkers, exposed to ideas that they disagree with.
This is CBS News.
Need hires who dazzle without the hassle? You need Indeed. Their powerful platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
Here's what you need to know in Western Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Kuska. A man is dead and a woman was seriously hurt after their vehicle crashed into a road grader in the village of Bruce this morning. The driver of the vehicle, a 73-year-old woman from Bruce, was flown to an Eau Claire hospital with serious injuries, while her passenger, an 80-year-old man from Bruce, died at the scene of the crash near Highway 8 at Highway 40, according to the Russ County Sheriff's Office. The driver of the road grader was not hurt. One person died after an ATV crash in Jackson County on Sunday. The Jackson County Sheriff's Office said that 65-year-old James Campbell of Black River Falls was killed when his ATV hit a tree near a trail in the town of Millston Sunday afternoon. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The state high school baseball championships began today in Grand Chute. Division 1 quarterfinals today. Tomorrow, Division 4 Ithaca plays Edgar at 9 a.m. followed by McDonald versus Pecatonica. In Division 3, it'll be Aquinas and Random Lake, followed by St. Croix Falls and Keele in the afternoon session. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
More than 7,000 truck accidents happen every year in Wisconsin. These accidents can be devastating, resulting in severe damage and trauma, often more severe than a regular car accident. Gingras Thompson & Wachs can help. They'll assist you not only with the driver of the semi, but also the trucking and insurance companies, making sure you receive the compensation you deserve.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson and Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigvi Olsen has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at BelongingBeginsWithUs.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
There's a lot to what's going to happen on Tuesday with Trump and the court appearance, and I'm going to get to that, but I first want to get to the phones. I got Dan in Chicago on line one. Dan, what's on your mind, brother?
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Just wanted to talk about the fact that I feel like the new Republican campaign slogan is the corrupt Justice Department. Yep. And the attack on the FBI. And so the Law and Order Party is seemingly becoming the less and less Law and Order Party. And I think I've only heard two Republican, I'll call them presidential nominees, or they're in better in the field, speaking out against Trump. And so Tom Hartman, who I listen to quite a bit, was speaking about that those folks that are not, that they are shaming this probe and this indictment, I feel like they're not really running for president. They're just running for vice president. Yep. Or a cabinet position of some sort.
Yep.
And it's crazy to me to see that happening, but I'm also not surprised because I've seen this party, which I used to be a part of, and now I'm as far left as you can imagine, but it's just crazy to see like that whole, you know, infrastructure just like crumble just because of one man who controls 33% of the Republican.
Yep. And the cowardice voters of the rest of the party. You're spot on.
It's insane. Yep. And you know, and Walsh, who I never agree with anything on. I agree with him on a lot of things that he was just talking to you about.
Well, that's how we became friends. Look, when he was in Congress, he was my chew toy. I used to beat up on him all the time, and you know, we've had conversations on that. And maybe we get back to that. But right now, it's about saving democracy, Dan. I appreciate the thoughts.
I agree completely. Yeah. Thank you for your show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But you know, the thing is when this happens on Tuesday, it's going to be an explosion for Trump, and this is going to be a huge thing. The question is, you know, how's this going to, what are we going to expect? That's why I've asked my good friend Renato Mariotti to come talk with us. Renato is a former federal prosecutor. He is also the host of the fabulous podcast On Topic, or It's Complicated. It's the It's Complicated podcast. I will get links out on social media how you do that. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. How you doing, Rick?
I am good. So what are we expecting on Tuesday? What's going to happen, do you think?
Sure. Well, I've handled, I don't know, a few hundred arraignments in my life at least. What's going to happen is he's going to go into the courthouse. The judge is going to make sure he's aware of the maximum penalty he's facing, which has absolutely nothing to do, by the way, with the actual sentence someone receives. It's just it's those bizarro numbers you hear, you know.
Yeah.
Paul Manafort is facing 580 years in prison or whatever it is, right? Some absurd number. You know, he will be notified of the charges against him. You know, in the olden days, they would actually read the indictment out loud. That's usually waived nowadays. And he will enter a plea of not guilty on all the counts. Then there's going to be some preliminary scheduling issues. In a case like this, a national security case, there's a kind of a protective order that's, you know, that's entered in the very beginning of the case to protect the sensitive material that's involved in the discovery. And there's going to be a bunch of date sets, and that's really it. It's a very, you know, perfunctory initial appearance that occurs in a case like this. He'll be informed of his rights and so forth, which are not going to surprise anyone. He'll be out on bond just like he was in the New York state case.
Now, I've had a couple people email me and say, well, it's a Trump-appointed judge. They may toss it. They may just quash it. Is that possible?
No, I mean, this won't even be before Judge Cannon. It's going to be before a magistrate judge, which is essentially not a I want to say not a real judge. They are real judges, but they're not a judge under Article 3 appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. They're kind of temporary judges for a period of time. And they're there to sort of perform some of these more ministerial duties,
okay,
like an arraignment. So this person is not going to be making a lot of big decisions tomorrow.
So any chance that Judge Cannon, you know, throws a wrench into this? Any chance of that?
Absolutely, just not not tomorrow.
Not tomorrow.
I mean, she's a pretty big wild card. I mean, if you're kind of thinking about what are the potential problems with this case, you know, what are the potential downsides, what might happen, there's no question that Eileen Cannon has got to be the top of the list. I mean, she could undo the entire case effectively. I mean, all she has to do is wait for the jury to be impaneled, and then she can effectively toss the case without really an ability to appeal that. So a lot of power that goes to the district judge in a case like this.
Any chance? Because I've had a bunch of people say, well, this is not a big deal. That's what's going to happen. I've even had people say, well, you know, they're going to be Trump supporters on that jury. You're never going to convict because the Trump supporters won't allow it. There are a lot of roadblocks in the way toward. So I don't want my lefty friends to get all excited. Oh, we got him like they did during the Mueller years. You know, this is a step in the right direction, but there are a lot of challenges along the way, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're a lot closer than Robert Mueller, okay? This isn't a report. This is an indictment. So right. That's a significant difference. The charges are pretty serious. The evidence appears to be very strong. So there's a lot for people to be encouraged about if they're looking for a conviction here. But absolutely, there are a lot of roadblocks. Eileen Cannon is one of them. She could totally throw a wrench in the works, quite literally. Like you said, One juror. All you need is one person who's got very strong feelings about Donald Trump who refuses to vote to convict, and that's that. You have a hung jury. By the way, you know, I was a federal prosecutor in Chicago when we prosecuted Rod Blagojevich. I was there during that first trial, and that first trial, the jury deadlocked on all but one count, and there was a single juror who was responsible for that. She just really liked Rod Blagojevich. So it's a very similar kind of figure, too, because they were very charismatic, fraudster types. OK, he convinced one person that was enough to get it past trial one. Obviously, there's a second trial and he was convicted on a whole slew of counts. But that first trial, that one juror made the difference.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because this isn't going to be the first indictment coming down. We're expecting Georgia. We're expecting more down the road. But this is the most significant, I think, to this point. I mean, you know, the thing in New York, yeah, that is what it is. But this is something I had a bunch of people tell me, no, it's, you know, it's the same as what Joe Biden did. What's the difference? And I've made my thoughts on this, but you're a federal prosecutor. You're the guy who looks at that 47 pages that I read with an amateur's eye. What in that is the most damning, do you think?
Wow. Well, there's a lot that's damning that's there. I certainly think that the words that his attorney said that he had told them was very damning. You know, according to his own attorneys, who, by the way, were hired by Trump to help him. They're not trying to bury him. They're trying to help him. I mean, according to the attorney, he told the attorney to lie to law enforcement to try to hide and destroy documents. Right. I mean, that's serious stuff. That's the way that criminals operate. That's not the way we expect a former president to operate. So, you know, that to me, that speaks a thousand words right there. Obviously, his own recorded statement effectively admits the crime there, right? Like, hey, I've got all the secret stuff. I could have declassified it, but I didn't. But I'm sharing it to you now. Let me tell you, right, the attack plans or something. And that was pretty amazing. Speaking a thousand words, you know, the photos of lots of classified documents in, like, the toilet. There's one, like, strewn on the floor, right, that Walt Nauta found. I mean, it's sort of like, what do you like? What's your favorite piece of evidence? There's so much to choose from there.
Yeah, I mean, the pictures from the Trump Presidential Library were priceless.
Was that the toilet?
Yeah.
But I will just say, you know, you asked earlier, before you asked me that question, you had also asked about the difference between this and, let's say, what President Biden allegedly did. And you could throw in others, Mike Pence or Hillary Clinton or whoever else. Okay. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, Biden and Pence are kind of in the same category. These are people who are vice presidents who left office. They had a lot of papers with them. And some of them turned out to be classified later on. They discovered them. They let the government know. They surrendered the papers. And there's an investigation. Now, I think Pence has already been cleared. Here's the crazy thing. Donald Trump was in exactly that same position shortly after his presidency. So there was a lot of boxes that went down in Florida. He had a fantastic defense. His defense was, I was the president. There's a lot of people moving boxes around, a lot of boxes going around. How do I know what's in the boxes? How do I know what these people are doing? I'm the president. I don't keep track of what's in some random box. Great defense. If he had just said, okay, just turn everything back over, it would have been done.
Yep.
And it's super clear when you read the indictment that they asked him very politely, like, pretty please, with sugar on it, will you give us the stuff back? A bunch of times. They eventually issued a subpoena. Then there's this, like, personal visit, like, where they came out, like, hey, have you read our subpoena? Please give us the stuff. And then all he's doing is he's trying to obstruct and find a way to get these documents. They were like his like, it's almost like a kid's diary or something. It was like these classified documents matter so deeply to him that he was willing to risk going to prison for them. It was really something.
No, it's crazy. And I think a lot of it speaks to, you know, to just who he is as a person, in my view. And I said at the beginning of the show, I think, you know, this is the first time in his life that anyone ever told him no, and he doesn't like it. And he's going to, as every 2 or 3 year old does, when you tell them no the first couple of times, they fight. They fight like hell to get what they want. This is how I see this.
Yeah, it's very juvenile. It really paints a bad picture of him. I mean, it is. One thing that really is something is, of course, to see how this is solidifying in many ways the support of some Republicans forever. They're still rallying around him. I mean, the picture it paints of him, even if you believe, I mean, there are defenses to this. The Republican defenses to this basically amount to two things. One is the Presidential Records Act means everything is his. OK, which is not actually what it says. It says basically the opposite. Or secondly, well, Hillary did it too.
Right.
Okay. Or Biden did it too, or whatever their thing is. But none of them are like, yeah, this is an amazing individual and he's doing a great job protecting our national secrets. Like, no one's saying that, right? Like, yes, like, I lock my biggest secrets in the toilet as well. Like, that's what I do. I, like, put my, you know, my will and my diamond jewelry. I put it all my valuables in my bathroom, or
not just the bathroom.
Hotel ballroom.
I mean, if you read the indictment, you know, these boxes, they traveled. They were in a ballroom. Oh, yeah. They were over here. They were over there. They kept shuffling them around, trying to find places to hide them. I mean, it's just remarkable. Last question I've got for you, because, you know, again, what the Republicans are doing, and I think for their base, this rings, you know, the victim card is what they've got to play, that this is all the DOJ doing Biden's bidding, that this is all a political witch hunt. They've weaponized the DOJ. Now, again, you've been a federal prosecutor. In looking at what's happened, I'm curious where you What are your thoughts on that kind of a victim card being played is?
The funny thing, it's such a juxtaposition, Rick. The funny thing is, anybody reading this indictment sees that the FBI and DOJ gave him special treatment. He was treated with kid gloves. I mean, I'll just tell you right now, I was a federal prosecutor for a decade, and I've been in private practice for the last several years. I was in private practice before then. Now I've been in private practice for several years. I represent clients all the time. And I'm just going to tell you right now, my clients don't get this sort of special treatment. When they have some evidence the government wants, I don't get like the special, like a happy thank you note or, you know, request. Hey, here's a polite letter. Would you please get us the contraband in your house? Would you please provide that to us? Take your time. Okay. But just, you know, you could just when you get around to it, would you please give it to us? I never get that. I mean, I get calls from people like, the FBI was trying, you know, was screaming at my wife saying I'm going to prison if I don't talk. I mean, that's the kind of calls I get from clients. I don't get calls like from clients who are like, oh yeah, the FBI is going to take us at our word that we returned all this stuff. Just let them know that we've done it, and just they'll take us at our word. I don't get those kind of calls. So yeah. The idea that this guy is the victim of some sort of witch hunt. This guy is literally been treated with the biggest kid gloves. But the irony of the whole thing, Rick, is that's what makes the case so strong. If they had gone in the way they ordinarily would, like if you or I, if in your little recording studio, if there was a bunch of classified documents in there, the FBI wouldn't wait. They would just go in and take the stuff, right? They might have, you know, you might have some defenses if they did that to Trump. But with Trump, the fact that they were so polite – ironically made the case much stronger.
So I guess last question, does he get convicted, and if he's convicted, does he see jail time?
Okay. First of all, if he's convicted, does he get convicted? He should be convicted. If this was John Doe, I would say it would be virtually a certainty.
Slam dunk.
Slam dunk. The two words that really really give me some pause is Eileen Cannon, and who knows, because she definitely could throw the case, tank the case, or throw the case if she wanted to. And then regarding prison time, if this was John Doe and he did not commit obstruction, it would be a few years if he pled guilty. That's what I've literally looked at comparable cases. People in the military just keep a bunch of docs in their house and for a few, don't give them back right away. They get a few years if they plead. With the obstruction, I would tell somebody, if you plead with the obstruction, maybe high single digits. If you go to trial, maybe low double digits. That would be my guess. But with Trump, who knows? I mean, Eileen Cannon could give him zero years of prison. It's a lot of discretion to the individual judge regarding sentencing. But I think this is as serious of a case as DOJ could bring. It may very well be the most serious case that DOJ ends up bringing.
We will see how this plays out. But Renato, as always, I appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule to keep us up on this and give us some thoughts. Thanks so much, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Our good friend Renato Mariotti. Remember, check out his podcast, It's Complicated Podcast. I'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'll tell you one of my favorite stories over the weekend that I came across. It's one of those things that drives me nuts. St. Louis, there was a story of parents. And again, I look at Trump, bad parenting by Donald Trump's parents. I think so. Someone who, again, I don't think has ever heard the word no. But evidently in St. Louis County, there were parents who were angry. In fact, the word I think the report used was fuming mad that they weren't able to go to their child's eighth grade graduation ceremony. Oh, no, they were fuming. Social media posts. This is my problem with social media. They never give you the whole story. They give you the outrage. They give you the, I was turned away. And my poor precious, look at her cry because she's so sad. So I had to go look this story up. And this is one of, again, what's wrong with our society and bad parenting. Turns out the little darlings that didn't get to go to their graduation, eighth grade graduation, were people who, well, poor attendance, fighting in school, other misdeeds, they messed up. And I started thinking back to when I was in school. I remember the 2 weeks before graduation. And the principal was very clear. You do something stupid, you don't get to walk. And kids understood that the ceremony of walking and getting your diploma was not about them. This isn't about the poor little precious eighth grader being able to walk and get, oh, I graduated from eighth grade. It had nothing to do with them. It had everything to do with the parents. And this is one of those weird moments where things have changed. Again, had I gotten kicked out of my high school graduation, and granted I was not anywhere near the top of the class, my grandmother would have lost her mind. Had they said, no, you can't go, she would have been very unhappy because that meant something to her. And as students, you don't want to disappoint your grandparents or your parents, or at least I hope you don't. And this is where having, oh, I don't know, common sense, and having parents that enforce rules, this is important. And I'm glad that this school did it. My question, and this is where my mind went, why aren't all the schools doing this? Why have we allowed parents to run roughshod over the local public schools in ways that the bad actors, the ones who are causing problems, not doing their work, not showing up for class, not doing, they get rewarded like everyone else? And I know I sound like an old curmudgeon. No, you know, there might be problems. Yeah, there might be problems. It's called bad parenting. Because I go back to, and if my mother were alive and if I didn't get to, well, I think about, you know, so, you know, the milestones in school that had my mother not got to see, she would have beat me senseless. And I know we're not allowed to hit kids anymore. That's bad. But there's got to be some punishment. Like my kids, I've never touched any of my children. But they don't know that I won't. And that fear is much worse than that actually happening. And they wouldn't anyway out of respect. At least I hope they wouldn't. But this is where we've gotten to as a society. This is how we, and social media is a huge part of this. Because I've said a million times, social media is where people are the worst versions of themselves. They're the worst possible people online. For instance, I said at the beginning, I got COVID last week, and it
I was starting to get my, making sure the will's up to date, making sure, because who knows, I'm struggling. Lungs are filling up with icky stuff, not happy, not breathing well. Better make sure everything's in order. You know, the old George Carlin, 2 minutes, get your you-know-what together. And I started, thinking about this. And I keep coming back to, the kind of society that we live in where no one's accountable anymore. No one's responsible. The Republican Party used to be the party of responsibility. They were supposed to be the fathers. If you remember those frames, they were supposed to be the paternalistic ones. And the Democrats were maternalistic. They were soft. They were, oh no, you poor baby. What happened to the Republicans? What happened to the paternalistic GOP? I want to know. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst, to share some thoughts on, what we're going to see over the next couple of days. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day that 18,000 workers in Chicago's stockyards went out on strike. Work in the stockyards was often brutal and dangerous. Thousands of workers toiled in the yards, many of them immigrants from Eastern Europe. They worked butchering and processing the hogs and cattle raised in the American West into meat for distribution by rail to consumers across the country. The industry gave Chicago the nickname Hog Butcher for the World. In 1904, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union organized a strike. The main demand was increased wages. The meatpacking companies were able to get scabs to cross the picket lines and act as strikebreakers. Most were African Americans and European immigrants. Many of these workers had not been organized by the union, which was dominated by the skilled German and Irish packing house workers. Novelist Upton Sinclair visited the stockyards during the strike to research conditions faced by the workers. In his famous novel, The Jungle, Sinclair gave a fictionalized account that captured the devastating impact of the scabs on the strike. He wrote, quote, "Such were the stockyards during the strike. While the unions watched in sullen despair, and the country clamored like a greedy child for its food, and the packers went grimly on their way. Each day they added new workers and could be more stern with the old ones, could put them on piecework and dismiss them if they did not keep pace." It was not until the 1930s when the stockyard unions took seriously the task of organizing across race, ethnic, and skill lines that they finally won a contract and gained the rights of union recognition.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
As Scottish literary giant Robert Burns wrote, "The best laid schemes of mice and men go oft awry." His 1785 poem, titled To a Mouse, could be directed today at the right-wing sloganeers who've been scheming so furiously to turn their hokey woke snobbery into a winning political stratagem. "Your local librarian is woke," they screech. "So is Disney Inc., some of your churches too, plus all Democrats and, oh my God, even Bud Light." Creeping wokeism is the new Red Scare, Welfare Queen and Willie Horton political bugaboos rolled into one, forming the main, quote, issue of Republicans now running for president, Congress, and dog catcher. But rather than getting defensive, insisting you are not woke, consider firing back by saying, "Of course I'm woke." For the great majority of Americans, being woke is a very positive characteristic, meaning you're awake, attentive to what's going on. Indeed, in black communities, stay woke has long meant staying alert to racial and social injustices. But even some Republicans must consider it bizarrely self-defeating for their party's top candidates to be urging voters to go to sleep. GOP leaders explain that anti-woke means crusading against DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusiveness. But wait, that means they're opposing America itself. For we are a nation united under the essential principle of e pluribus unum.
As affirmed by everything from the Declaration of Independence to our kindergarten teachings of sharing and fairness, ours is a country rooted in constant diversification, expanding equality, and the democratic idea that every voice ought to be included. Our country needs more of all three. This is Jim Hightower saying, America is way short of achieving these historic ideals, but shame on those demanding we abandon even striving for them. Confront the charlatans.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Tell you, I'm really looking forward to see what's going to happen on Tuesday. And I know a lot of folks are, you know, oh my gosh, you know, finally. Finally. And here's the thing. A lot of folks I know didn't think this was going to happen. In fact, my next guest, I'm going to kind of jab him a little bit here. Because he said this was never going to happen. And it has. That's why I've asked my good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to come back and share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So, thoughts?
Well, now, see, let me give this answer. I never thought Merrick Garland would indict him.
Okay. See, that I will agree with you on.
Yes. And I was telling somebody, I did not think he would be indicted on this. I will tell you that I still don't believe Merrick Garland would ever, ever, ever indict him on this. But the special prosecutor is different, and Merrick Garland did not interfere. Merrick didn't. So, you know, that was made clear that it was the choice of the special prosecutor.
Yeah, so now, you know, look, I read the 47-page document, and there's a lot of stuff in there, Bob. There's a lot of bad.
Oh, there's, it's look, two lawyers have quit. Trump spent most of his day today trying to, interview lawyers for Miami. Trustee Rowley have had two lawyers upped and resigned. They just said it was time to go. They didn't, you know, give the rationale. And I think that the most telling interview on this, which was I found fascinating, was Barr, who admits during the interview, former Attorney General William Barr, admits during the interview that, you know, first the Mueller report, he defended Trump on that, and then other additional reports, the impeachments, you know, he defended Trump, et cetera. Then Barr launches into the legal side of this. Now, the one thing I still will, you know, caution on this is that this is a jury trial.
Right.
And statistically, they're going to find people who voted for Trump on that jury, and statistically people who didn't vote for Trump on that jury, and statistically people, you know, who didn't vote for Trump or Biden on that jury. And I mention that because jurors are human beings, and all it takes is one to hold out. So I don't like to predict the Supreme Court, and I never like to predict the jury, you know, in most cases. This one is unique, and also they're going to do things legally that they wouldn't do if this were not a former president,
yep.
The defense team. They're going to do it. They're going to make motions. They're going to, argue constitutional issues. Does that bump up? I mean, do you stop the trial and say, well, wait a minute, we've got to decide this constitutionally, and it goes to another court? Yeah, I don't know.
No, I fully expect them to drag this out as long as they can. Because they don't want it to happen before the election.
Absolutely.
But they get to play the victim card so much longer.
Well, right. And also, but supposedly, I was told this by a lawyer, I don't know how accurate it is, but supposedly Florida goes faster for trials. I don't kind of buy that. Anything can be drug out.
Yep.
And also, the Manhattan
indictment. That's scheduled for December, and Trump's lawyers are trying to make that go later, you know, throughout the year. Now, the one thing, and I was wrong. I did not think, again, that he would be indicted on this, because I just didn't think justice would do it. And also based on the fact of Biden had some documents and, you know, Pence had some documents, et cetera, and I figured a kind of a political weigh-in, but with a special prosecutor, I don't think that counts. Plus, he's going for some different statutes, you know, the espionage statute, you know, for example, than I thought he would. I'm still going to hold to the fact of what I said on your show this February and the previous 2022 February, which is I still don't think Donald Trump will be running in the Republican National Convention. And if anything, whether he's found innocent or he's found guilty of this, I think it really will be a factor. And if there's a decision on January the 6th and or a decision on Georgia, I think that about seals the fate of being able to hold a base together. I mean, Chris Christie's coming out swinging, and what you're going to have is, even though the bulk of the candidates defended him, Republican candidates, you're still going to have the group movement that, you know, behind their breath is like, you know, you guys really don't want him, do you?
Yeah. No, the part of my head that's logical agrees with you. The fact that I know so many Trump supporters who don't care. In fact, the fact that he is criming is something that they're okay with. So, you know, the fact that he is a bully, that he, you know, maybe I'm going to take what I want and up yours, that's something that resonates with them. So I'm still in the camp of I think it's his to lose. And then my concern is if you don't try him before the election, he quashes all this stuff when he appoints, you know, the next DOJ, and this all was for naught.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing I've been saying, and I'll make this real clear, if he's indicted and convicted, he still could win the Republican National Convention. So I do want to make that clear.
Right.
If he, because I always say he won't be in the Republican National Convention. I always say that because if he goes into the convention officially, he will win it. I don't care what he's done. He will win that convention.
Yes.
I'm thinking and have thought for quite a while he will find a way that he is not running for.
Okay, so just so I'm clear on this, because I want to make sure, because you're saying he's going to bail.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure that we get that right. He's going to bail.
He won't lose. Like I've said in the past, he won't lose. But I've always been, you know, very careful when I've been talking about this to say he won't be in the Republican convention. That's the difference.
So
he wins.
So walk me through this, because I see this, and I've had some of my liberal friends call me crazy, but I see this as a huge gift for Trump, because it lets him play that victim card all the time. They're coming after us. Yeah. They want to take me away from you. This is a rallying cry to get that base that isn't, you know, as fervent as they once were, to give them some red meat to get out there with their, you know, their muskets and start marching in the streets.
Well, here's what I base this totally on, and have, and it's all based on personal feelings with Donald Trump himself. And the reason I say that is this. Again, I agree, Rick. This helps him. It's a victim card. If he goes into the convention, he wins. If he goes in, you know, if he's in prison, he wins the convention. So I want to make that clear. But I just have never believed he will find a way to not run. And the reason I say that is because when I say it's personal with Donald Trump, this does nothing to hurt him in winning or losing the Republican convention. It helps him. But in the general election, this makes him toast with, and I don't care how, you know, bad Biden's doing it at this time or you know, whatever. But this makes him toast with independents and swing voters. And I think because of that, in his mind, he doesn't want to lose a second time, even, quote, if it's stolen. Now, after saying all of this, let me be a hypocrite for a second, because I warn friends of mine, it still could be a close election because there's some unknowns with President Biden, you know, that could turn out not so good.
Yep.
So I would still say if he runs, it could be a tight election. I just don't think he's going to run because I think deep in his mind, he knows that he is toast and it would be such a struggle with the independents and the people who went from, you know, Obama to Trump and then back to Biden, you know, the swing voters.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. So do you think any of the big guy stuff, do you think any of the stuff that Republicans are doing in the House right now to, oh, we've got the information. We know what he's done. He got $5 million. He got paid off. You think any of that, do you think there's anything there? And do you think that's going to come out?
Well, I mean, you never know, but the reason I have doubts on it is this. Whenever you have a criminal case, and I will talk from experience, in my case, you had people coming forth that provided bizarre information, ridiculous at best information. I had received a free boat from the Shah of Iran's daughter. Somebody else gave me a penthouse to live in Georgetown. They, you know, all these kinds of things. So those are, you know, somebody that would have access to the case would say, well, that's in there. He got a boat from the Shah's daughter. It's in there. So if you read, you know, all the people they interviewed, there's going to be some things like that in there. And in this case, I think at the presidential level, if in fact they had something tapes of Joe Biden saying, yeah, give me $5 million, you know, and it's yours, I think that thing would have rolled out a long time ago.
Again,
we're going to be looking at allegations made as cases are, you know, looked at or presented by the government. And again, I used a real example just now. Another one was a birthday party. They were going to investigate where supposedly somebody paid for a birthday party, which never happened. You know, stuff like that that people throw out there. Yeah. So I think in the president's case, that's what you're seeing.
Yeah, as I said from the beginning, if you can draw me a line that isn't just Hunter Biden and Jim and the rest of them doing what relatives do with people in power and using their name to put a couple of bucks in their pocket, if you can show me how that there was a quid pro quo of Biden doing something for them to get something, unless you can show me that path, there's nothing here. Or do you see it differently?
No, unless there's a direct path. In my case, the government knew that they did not have a quid pro quo from Abramoff to me. They knew it. We knew they knew it. They knew they knew it. If they did have it, there would have been an indictment. They wouldn't have went back and forth of a poker table dance. We could indict. You want to do a plea deal? If they have something, they go.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
No,
that's how they operate. Like I said, been there, done it. So they would have to have a quid pro quo on tape where it's, you know, Joe Biden saying, why don't you give me $5 million and I'll do the following for you. They would have to have that kind of thing on tape.
Yeah, I want to get your thoughts. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Bob Nay, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I want to get your thoughts on the House because the temper tantrum, evidently the Freedom Kooks have, I guess they're ending, the headline read, they end their floor blockade. So the temper tantrum is I guess, waning a little bit. But they're still thinking on how they can go after Kevin McCarthy. Any thoughts on this latest temper tantrum?
Sure. He's done a deal with them, is what the speaker has done. And let's call it a temporary deal because it's going to happen again. All right? So when they were asked about, you know, what are you going to do? The media asked them, I think there were six or seven of them in the room at the time, the Freedom people. This is before they went to the floor and stopped routine business. bills from going through the rules. And they said, what are you going to do, you know, if he does this deal with President Biden and it has a vote, we're going to vacate the chair. Who will vacate the chair of the media? So one guy put his hand up. Can't remember which congressman it was, but one of them put his hand up. Because, you know, that's what they said. Well, we will vacate the chair because
right.
they got their way with one member doing it. Well, they didn't vacate the chair because they know if they vacated the chair would sit empty for 4.5 months because even they don't have a candidate they can get votes from. And the Democrats would probably go to McCarthy and there might be a deal struck. So they knew that. So they did these, you know, tactics, blockading, et cetera. And which eventually, by the way, would have grown against them against their side because they're going to stop things that other members want to have out there. So McCarthy does an arrangement, right? He meets with them. He's doing some kind of deal with them. They aired their issues is what they said, and the floor will be functioning. Now, I can tell you right now, because I love these little nuggets to give them on your show, you know, the inside open secrets. I used to give out rooms, and we would do it in coordination with the speaker, the hideaways, they call them.
Right.
There's not many of them. So they're little secret rooms throughout the lower levels of the Capitol. Every once in a while, if we had like a real problem or they really, really needed somebody, I'd get a phone call from the speaker's office. Any rooms available, you know? And so a member might get a hideaway, you know? Some of these members might have went privately to the speaker and said, hey, you know, down the line, can I have that subcommittee chairmanship? So there's all kinds of things that could have happened here.
Now, there's tons of sweeteners and that. Now, did anyone ever ask for the room to bring someone down there to smack him around a little bit? Because that's where my mind goes.
Well, I could really answer something else, but I won't. Mine involves smacking.
Okay. Moving right along.
Yeah, moving along. So the other thing about the Freedom Caucus was this. The reason they, quote, cut a deal and they have this power-sharing agreement is because, Rick, they couldn't hold out doing these tactics. They were angering all the rest of the membership on the Republican side.
Yeah.
So they, quote, came to terms. This was just them thumping their chest and,
So like children, they had their tantrum.
That was it.
And now we're going to move, somewhere. I'm not going to say forward, but we're moving somewhere. So last question I got for you. Tuesday, the big hearing. There's lots of talk of potential violence. There's lots of talk of protest. What are you going to be paying attention to as you're watching the day unfold?
Well, I mean, he's what you mean for the
yeah, for showing Trump's, up to the Trump's court appearance.
Yeah, his court appearance. I mean, there's going to be a lot of publicity, obviously. People are going to be going crazy. It's an event of the century. And the media will go insane with it. It'll make statements. I don't expect, though, I really don't expect, a ton of violence. People will turn out. I don't expect people to turn out in droves, though.
No, see, I don't either.
I really don't.
But we will see. I've had Joe Walsh earlier tell me he thinks there's going to be a lot of people. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not seeing it. Cause...
I mean, are there going to be 10,000, 15,000? That would be a lot of people. No. There might be, 1,000 or 800 or something. Yeah. But I just don't think it's going to be what Trump would want it to be.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we'll see how much money he raises after his after the hearing.
Oh, he will raise money. Yeah.
Oh no, he's got a fundraiser right after, so we'll see how this plays for him.
No doubt.
Good stuff,
he'll
Bob.
Raise money.
Appreciate the time as always.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What are you going to be paying attention to? What are you watching for? Is it going to be will the Nazis be not marching down the streets in Miami? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. In 1981, the Los Angeles Dodgers
dropped the first two games of the World Series to their rivals, the New York Yankees. The Dodgers would come roaring back, sweeping the next four games, and so close the curtain on one of the strangest seasons in baseball history. The strangeness of the season began on this day in labor history. This was the first day of a strike that would last until August 9th. Nearly a third of all games were canceled. The reason for the strike was free agency. The players had won the right to become free agents a year after their contracts ended. Before this change, owners could renew players' contracts year after year, effectively stopping players from with other teams. Determined to reverse the gains won by the players' union, owners brought in Roy Grabey as a negotiator. Grabey had a tough reputation for representing management for General Electric and for Pan American World Airlines. He took that same hard-nosed approach to the baseball bargaining table. The owners wanted the right to receive a player of comparable value for any player lost to free agency. This would effectively discourage teams from signing free agents if they had to give up another valuable player in return. The players' union understood this was a tactic to undermine free agency. Many also saw it as an attempt to break the players' union. Sports Illustrated magazine declared it the walkout owners provoked. Finally, the two sides agreed to a compromise that kept the practice of free agency intact. In a controversial decision, baseball owners decided to split the season into two. The teams with the best records from each half of the strike-divided season went to the playoffs.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Good story here. And it's one of those things, our friends over at the Blue Green Alliance, they've come out with some interesting numbers when looking at the Inflation Reduction Act and the fact that we're moving towards building some clean energy, the jobs that are going to be created. As their report points out, solar job production is going to grow from about the 300,000 that we have now to about 4.5 million in 2035. They're saying that's more than a five-fold increase in solar jobs, and solar will be one of the top jobs in this country. And you go, you know, we need the manufacturing, we need the installation, we need the servicing, we need all of that stuff. They point out that the Inflation Reduction Act introduced 3.7 million new solar jobs, including 2.5 million in manufacturing, 1.2 in operations and construction. And without this investment that we're making, that we the people are making, solar jobs would have increased just by 500,000 to 800,000. We were moving down the path anyway. The market was moving us there, but this influx, this boost, is going to get us down the road faster. And this is one of those things. It's incredible to me that we haven't gone full on. Hey, you know, we've got those southwestern states that got a lot of open space. You know, you could, yeah, I don't know, put a roof over it. You know, use some of those solar panels to, you know, oh, I don't know, create some electricity so that, you know, places like Phoenix and Tempe, if you do run out of power, you know, don't. I mean, this is what I love hearing from people. You know, if we go to all electric, you know, the things could go out. And you go, yeah, have you heard of batteries? You know, this is where we create a grid. This is where we create the future. This is that opportunity and the jobs that come with it. So I give Joe Biden credit. And look, you know, as someone said earlier, Biden's got a record to run, and he does. He's created millions of jobs. We've invested in the first time in decades in our infrastructure. We're creating industries. We're bringing industries back. There's a lot of opportunity to get away from red hat, blue hat. There's a lot of opportunities to say, you know what? Don't care what team you're on. It's about moving the country forward, investing in the future, and making us as independent and as powerful as we can be. You know, there was a story today that, you know, Trump actually tried to get other countries to lower production of fuel, to raise prices, to save the oil industry. I know, but Donald cares about us. Get out of here. Just lunacy. And finally, Ted Cruz evidently has introduced a bill that's going to ban investment funds from leveraging private money, private retirement accounts, to push their ESG, their environmental, social, governance, and their diversity, equity, and inclusion. Because hey, you know, those are all horrible things. What Ted Cruz never did? He never stopped corporate America from robbing your pensions. He never stopped corporate America from screwing working people over. But the second working people go, you know what? We'd like to have better opportunities. We'd like to see things a little different. That bridge way too far. You know which side Ted's on. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast.